This is Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be talking to you about developments here during the week of January the 8th, 2018, that have come up in federal tax matters. It's been kind of a quiet week this week, and frankly, not much has happened. So we're going to start with what's actually fairly simple news, but it's probably the biggest development of the week. News release IR 2018-1 was issued on January the 4th. And what it really tells us is just the dates when things are going to start happening this year. There had been some concern that due to the changes in the tax law, that filing season might be delayed. As we became aware, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, not a whole lot of things had an effective date as of last year. Just things, bonus depreciation is probably the biggest thing that had an effective date last year. So IRS is going to be able to start up and get running only slightly later than normal. They will begin accepting returns on January the 29th of 2018 for 2017 for individual filers. So your clients can start submitting returns as of the date. You can start submitting them as of that date. The IRS does warn us again that Congress requires earned income tax credits and advanced child tax credit refunds to be delayed by law. They can be paid out no earlier than February 15th. And the IRS indicates this year that probably if you have direct deposit or take a debit card, they're going to start showing up on February the 27th this year. About that date will be when it will show up. So if you have clients impacted by that, you're going to have to tell them to expect that at the end of February. Also, the due date this year for the individual returns is April 17th. The way you get there is April 15th falls on a Sunday, so that's not the due date. April 16th, which would normally be the due date when the date falls on the Sunday, we'd move to Monday, but that will be Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia. So that moves us to April the 17th for our filing date. So your clients need to be aware that Tuesday, April 17th will be the date that returns will actually be due in the coming year. Now, as I said, this week, not a whole lot happened. And in fact, we actually only have some stuff to talk about this week because the IRS released a series of information letters. These are informal letters the IRS issues most often in response to letters from congressmen. And usually, to be totally honest, it's going to be their staff. It's not going to be the congressman who writes this letter on behalf of the constituent asking for information. So the IRS tends to issue them, not always to congressmen, but that's most often we get here. The first one is going to be looking at information letter 2017-0030. It was released by the IRS on December the 29th. And this letter, we have an employee retirement account. The employee died. The employer apparently continued to hold the funds in the account and now began paying it out to the designated beneficiary of the employee, which was the employee's surviving spouse. Now it looks like we're going to, or we have exhausted the account with, or not exhausted the account, I should say, but the surviving spouse is not going to exhaust the account. And now the surviving spouse passes away. The question becomes, the surviving spouse is now designated. Let's assume surviving spouse designates surviving spouse's son to be the new beneficiary. Can we take that funds out of the employer account? Because probably, to be totally honest, the employer account said we're going to pay the surviving spouse out of our account, but we're not about to pay, you know, these other third-party relatives. We're probably going to have a forced payout. So can we, or are they required to allow us to transfer that to an inherited IRA? And the answer became, unfortunately, even though that's what we want to do, the IRS looked at the law and notes that under the law, only a beneficiary of the employee can have the amount transferred to an IRA. Now, we're required to allow them to transfer an inherited IRA if it's going to a beneficiary, you know, a non-spouse beneficiary. That was cleared up a couple of years ago in the law that the plans have to offer that option, both first that they could, that was a 2006 Pension Act, and then after that, they clarified that, yeah, that didn't just mean they could, it meant plans had to allow it. But the IRS makes clear in this case, we don't have a designated beneficiary of the employee. We instead now have a designated beneficiary of the spouse. Now, this could probably have been avoided had the spouse, instead of taking the funds, assuming the spouse had the right to take a distribution of the funds when the original employee died, if that spouse had taken the money and placed it into an IRA and then treated that as the spouse's own IRA, which is all of which is allowed, then the surviving spouse clearly could have named as the new beneficiary, you know, the beneficiary at that person's death, the surviving spouse's death, to be anybody he or she wanted to name. But having left it in the employer plan, yeah, it's not going to be treated as surviving spouse's account. And because of that, we don't have a designated beneficiary that can have it treated as an inherited IRA in their name that we can transfer it to. So an interesting issue, if you run into this, you have some options. This is one of the things to talk about clients with if they have this option. There may be a reason to get it out of the employer account and get it into an IRA in the name of the surviving spouse, if in fact the surviving spouse is not going to exhaust the account. And it turns out the kids maybe are not going to just go spend the money as soon as mom or dad dies, and you know that money comes to them. We had another retirement account problem that the IRS issued information letter on. This information letter is 2017-0028, also issued on December the 29th. And this was a case of a taxpayer that, well, it took him a while to raise this concern, but the taxpayer became concerned about amounts he had transferred out of a 401k account in 2006, and he thought he'd made a mistake. Now, as it turns out, what I expect happens is the taxpayer discovered recently that there were options available for rolling over funds that are paid with after-tax contributions into an employer plan. And having read about that and that you could do it today, just assume that could have been done back in 2006. But his concern was that since he transferred after-tax money into a traditional IRA account, he was concerned that he'd never get credit for the fact that he'd already paid tax on that money. And, you know, how could he correct that today and get credit for it? Because he said what he really meant to do was put that money in a Roth IRA back in 2006. Well, the IRS pointed out that the law, the 2006 Pension Act, did allow us to roll funds from an employer account to a Roth IRA. But that act only allowed it for distributions after 2007. So the distribution he got in 2006 would not have been allowed to go into a Roth IRA. All that it could have done at that point been put it into a regular IRA, and then we could have rolled it to a Roth IRA, presumably, you know, from converted the regular IRA to a Roth IRA, done the conversion, you know, went through all that mess and paid tax at that point. So we could have converted, but we couldn't just, you know, take the after-tax money and put it into a Roth directly back in 2007. But what about his concern about the lost money then? Because he had paid tax on that money, right? He put after-tax money into an employer 401k. And yes, if the plan allows it, that can be done. You know, you don't see that often, but you do see it from time to time. So the problem is, you know, has he just kind of put himself, you know, into a position where he'll never get credit for that? The IRS points out if you do this, that's considered basis, and it's covered by the standard rules for when you have made non-deductible contributions to an IRA. The taxpayer should file Form 8606 with their tax return, and that will allow them to calculate the basis that's involved in those share in the amount that's coming to them. You know, now we all know that the basis is going to be based on your basis in the IRA over the total value of the IRA. So, you know, you're not going to be able to just reach in and take out the basis. You're always going to get a proportion, and you're not going to get all the basis out till you get all the IRA out. So it's going to take a while to get there, but you still recover it. Form 8606 will allow for that recovery to get you the return of basis. So the taxpayer, at least there is a way to recover the money that he thought he had blown. And also, you know, be careful of that. We have clients do that from time to time too, just I think like this client. They'll suddenly read an article in Fortune, you know, or in the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, it'll be something that now they say, yes, if you get a distribution from the plan that has this sort of thing in it, you could put it in a Roth IRA, and they'll go, oh, I can't believe you fouled this up. That distribution I did back in 2006, you got it wrong. I'm going to be paying tons of money. Yeah, you know, you got to remind them tax laws change. If nothing else, remind them a couple of weeks ago, tax laws changed. And because of that, you know, it very well wasn't possible back in those days. And yes, that's kind of what appears to have happened here. A taxpayer became aware of what you could do today. But the fact you can do it today doesn't mean you could do it back then. We did have a couple of court cases this week. We did not really have much of anything coming out this week, to be totally honest. This was a very, very limited week for developments. But one case we did have was a case of Bishop versus Commissioner, the first summary opinion of 2018, the first and to date, the only summary opinion of 2018. And actually, to be totally honest, one of the very few opinions that came out this week. It was issued on January the 4th, and it deals with a question of a taxpayer and whether they are an innocent spouse. In this particular case, the taxpayer, what had happened was the taxpayer had, you know, the taxpayer and his spouse filed a joint return for the year. During the year, the taxpayer's spouse had taken money out of an inherited IRA that she had received from her father. Of the amount she received, there was like $2,700 or some fund in that area that was withheld for taxes. There was another chunk of money was used to benefit her daughter. And again, we don't know if the taxpayer was ever informed of that transaction. He claims he wasn't. The other spouse claims he was, but that's one of those he said, she said problems. And then $6,000 went into their joint checking account, an account which the taxpayer used and used his debit cards, paid bills, etc. Now, that $6,000 for these taxpayers was basically significantly more than the normal balance that should be in that checking account. And this taxpayer obviously had spent money out of that account. Presumably, we hope that when he spent money out of the account, he did go look to see if there was money in there, so he's aware of how much money was in the account. You know, so basically the idea was that he should have known. It was open. It went into a joint account. It was an account he not only had access to, but he used with his debit card or by paying checks and doing those things during the year. Now, he asked for innocent spouse relief. And the IRS said, okay, well, we need to look at this. Okay, we have what the ex-wife did. 6015B is the first test they did for innocent spouse relief. And that's the general innocent spouse relief rules. But 6015B bars relief if a taxpayer knows or should have known about the income in question. In essence, ignorance does not solve your problem under 6015B. So under 6015B, the IRS concluded, well, he should have known. I mean, $6,000 went into a joint checking account. It was way more money than normally went into that account. You know, had he been paying attention, it would have occurred to him, where'd that money come from? And that should have allowed him to ask the question about the money. Okay. Now, by the way, they had always used and did that year in question professional preparer. They had received distributions in prior years, but that year apparently didn't provide a 1099-R to the preparer. And according to the ex-spouse, you know, well, they just forgot about the distribution. That's why they didn't provide the 1099-R. And by the way, that's why she's taking the position that, you know, he shouldn't be let off the hook. This should be a joint and several liability. So the tax court said, well, you should have known. The tax court agreed with the IRS's view on this. Yes, he clearly should have known about this money. So there's no way to get B relief. But if the year following their, you know, filing this return, they separated. And the year after that, the divorce became final. So now we're at the point where these two taxpayers are divorced. 6015C allows additional innocent spouse relief options if taxpayers are now divorced. And 6015C, interestingly enough, requires that you not have actual knowledge, but says nothing about things you should have known. So the IRS concluded and the tax court agreed that under C, ignorance is actually bliss. While the court said there's no question he should have known about the money, the spouse never testified that she had actually told him about the distribution. So, you know, there was no testimony on her part because she was contesting this, obviously. You know, the IRS had granted him relief. So the intervener, in this case, the ex-wife, was saying, wait, that shouldn't happen, because if that does happen, she's the one that's going to have to write the entire check. So she says, no. And they said, well, you never told us you told him. And we agree, had he looked in the checking account, he should have known. But you also never testified. There's no evidence that he ever actually looked at the balance. And by the way, as weird as that seems, there are a whole lot of taxpayers that follow, or a whole lot of not necessarily taxpayers or non-taxpayers, you know, just people in general, that believe as long as there's still checks in the checkbook, it's still okay to keep writing, right? And they figure the ATM machine will tell them when they can't use the debit card anymore. So since there was no evidence he'd actually looked at the bank account, therefore no evidence he ever saw the $6,000 deposit, well, that may have been reckless. It may have been something that he really shouldn't have done. The reality was there was no demonstration of actual knowledge, and the two sections have different tests. Without a showing of actual knowledge, the intervener's request to have him denied innocent spouse relief was turned down. Rather, the tax court agreed with the IRS that he was entitled to under 6015C, innocent spouse relief. This case is really a reminder of just how messy and complicated innocent spouse cases get, right? There are all kinds of different things. And you've got the IRS rulings and the tests they use internally to determine who does or doesn't qualify for innocent spouse relief. By the way, we had another option here. You could have gone beyond this, of course, to 6015E and said, well, it just was, you know, would be unfair to hold him liable. And they actually did have arguments on that. But as the court said, we don't need to go there because he doesn't need to show that it'd be patently unfair to hold him liable. Rather, he's covered by C. So they said C was okay. The other thing to always remember, I want to tell people always, whenever we talk about an innocent spouse, remember, innocent spouse is always a conflict of interest problem and probably one you cannot solve even with a waiver. The interests of the two parties are so objectively, diametrically opposed. Whenever it appears that innocent spouse claim should be raised, that's usually the time that whoever is currently representing the married couple needs to step out of the case and allow the parties to get independent representation to move forward, one of them to raise the innocent spouse claim and the other one to protest the innocent spouse claim. The person that was involved up to date representing the couple really is almost without exception conflicted out. It's going to be very difficult to show that you could provide the same level of representation to both as if the conflict didn't exist, when it's just obvious that in these cases, they basically, you know, they're going to have wildly different interests in the case. Finally, a case that won't apply to a lot of people, but it, I guess would apply to some. This is the case of Rafazadeh, and I really know that's not the name, but we'll deal with that, versus Commissioner. The first published tax court case of 2018, 150 TC number 1, was issued on January the 2nd, the first day the court was in session this year. So very first case of the year. In this case, the taxpayer failed to report income from foreign sources on their tax returns from 2006 to 2009. Now, that's important because Congress added in 2010 a special rule under 6038 Cap D that first required you all remember to report the specified foreign assets on the 1040. We have to do that reporting every year. And Congress also said that the six-year statute normally applies if you've left off too much gross income, would also apply if you had not reported income from a specified foreign asset. Now, what Congress didn't make clear was when did that take effect? In essence, if you had failed to report income from a foreign asset account in a year that was still open under the statute when Congress passed this law, did it now get a six-year statute? That has definitely happened in the past, where Congress has extended a currently open statute. Or did this only apply for 2010 going forward? And it was an issue of interpreting the statute. The IRS said that it applied all the way back. Because if it didn't, then the IRS raised these claims too late. The statute would bar them going after the money. The tax court found, though, that when reading the statute, it talked about having to report foreign income on any, you know, on any, if you failed to report foreign income on an account that was required to be reported under 6038D. It said the most logical way to read that section was that there had to be a 6038D reporting obligation for the year in question. because there was no 6038D reporting obligation in 2006 to 2009, because there was no 6038D in the code at that point, that in fact the statutes were not extended for those years. The court totally agreed that Congress could have extended those statutes. They could have reworded it. And they said they had done so. They point out in other laws where they had done so, you know, where they include words like for any taxable year, not just for years, and make it very clear when it's to apply. The tax court said in this case, Congress specifically didn't mention for any taxable year or open it up to that extent. So for that reason, the court found that, yeah, we don't open the six-year statute. Obviously, if you have a client who has this problem, by the way, if you have a client who has this problem, they probably should have been talking to an attorney too, because they very well may have FBAR and other issues in play. And potentially, by the way, the other way for the IRS to open up the statute would be on the fraud route, where they don't need to. They were not going the fraud route here. They were just going for the fact that this income had been omitted. It obviously wasn't huge because they couldn't get the six-year statute under omission of gross income. And most likely because it wasn't that much, at least, you know, compared to their total income, the odds are of the IRS carrying fraud would probably been pretty low too. So they had to go down this path. But, you know, you have to be careful there. But if you have a case like this, yes, we have some information on statutes. It's also rather useful as a case to look at to see how the court goes about interpreting the law. Why is that important? We just had a whole bunch of law added to the code a couple weeks ago. Remember, on December 22nd, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act signed into law, a whole bunch of new material got added to the code, none of which have regulations to explain them yet. So all of this is things that we're going to have interpretations, how you read the law. Something I think a lot of CPAs need to be aware of is how Congress and how the tax court reads the law. Understand, number one rule to always keep in mind, if the code itself is clear as written, it really doesn't matter what a committee report says. If a committee report says something, but the law doesn't say it, it also doesn't matter what a committee report says, because that's irrelevant. Congress has to actually put it in the law. And if the law says the opposite of what the committee report says, then the law still covers. The committee reports are mainly of interest. And by the way, we're going to have blue books probably too. I'm going to assume the Joint Committee will come out with a blue book on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. But that also only matters if there's ambiguity in the law as written. If there is no ambiguity, it doesn't matter what the blue book or the conference report says. You know, the first place you always go for law is to the law itself. And if you can get the answer just from the law itself, the IRS can't change that by reg. And the Congress can't try to change it by, you know, playing with the blue book or committee reports. That doesn't work after the fact. If it's not clear, then and only then do we turn to sources like the blue book in order to try to interpret maybe what did Congress really mean. There's like three ways to read this. Which one of the three ways is closest to what appears Congress intended? Well, we do have, as I mentioned last week, Tax Act presentations coming up. Some of you may have been aware we did a webcast version of the Tax Act. I'm going to be redoing that on January the 19th. It will be a true live broadcast. This is not a rebroadcast with me sitting there answering questions if you have them. We're actually going to talk about it because some things have changed. Like, for instance, those of you who were in the broadcast we did a couple weeks ago know that during that broadcast, President Trump signed the bill. So this time we're going to start not saying what happens if he doesn't sign the bill before the end of the year, et cetera. We already know he signed the bill by the end of January. And we'll also update probably in our discussion of deferred taxes, which was very important, the fact that the SEC has taken action since then. And on January 10th, for those of you who are not aware, the Financial Accounting Standards Board is scheduled to consider what they maybe should do about deferred taxes for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And should they allow private companies to make use of what the SEC is allowing public companies to do? So you might all want to take a look at that too. The FASB will be working on January the 10th. My understanding is they normally stream those sessions. So if you really want to sit there and listen to some gap discussions about deferred taxes, January the 10th. And by the way, if that's a big issue for you, if you got a gap financial doing audits or reviews with gap statements, and you're going to have to get a deferred tax provision in there, might not be bad to try to figure out what FASB is going to end up doing. But for those of you who want to come back in when our discussion after that on January 19th, we'll be doing one again because it's webcast and live. It goes at one real time, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. Some of the state societies are working with us on this, so check your state society's website for signups. If not, you can sign up through Smart Pros. We're working that way as well, and that information should be available, you know, for us here on the website where we have all the notes for this session. Also doing, again, as I mentioned last week, on January the 26th, the Arizona Society of CPAs, I'll be doing a four-hour, right? The webcast is two. I should say the webinar is two. The webcast here and the live session are 4 hours from the Arizona Society. If you can make it to the Phoenix office, fine. We'll be going at 12:30 that afternoon. Gil Blumenthal is doing ethics in the morning. So after Gil finishes up that day, I will come in the afternoon and be doing a 12:30 p.m. session. That'll be going, that's again, at 12:30 Mountain Standard Time. They'll also, if you can't make it to Phoenix, that will also be webcast. And don't forget, all of your state society CPAs, you know, almost everybody is working on something to try to help you get up to date with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you know, before your clients start coming in and want you to explain the whole things to them. So be sure to check for your continuing education options on your state society's website. You know, keep an eye out. A lot of them probably have emailed you about what they're doing in that realm. You probably want to get some experience. I've listened to a number of presentations because, by the way, everybody, including those of us that do the webcast, are still trying to figure out and learn this law. One person pointed out kind of funny that, you know, that they were checking with their tax subscription service and noticed that, in fact, the size of the document that was supposed to explain the law had suddenly changed. Yes, because all of us are still trying to figure out how this thing works and what's happening. So it's actually very useful to get, you know, some multiple inputs about how this law is working. So check your state society, see what options they have. And by the way, in many cases, I think you're going to find there are going to be multiple options of how you can study. Might not be a bad idea to pick up a couple of different viewpoints about how this law works. With that, this has been the current federal tax developments this week. Again, not much happened this week. For January the 8th, you can catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also send any questions or comments. You can send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do post updates on Twitter at Ed Zollers. You can follow me there. I also have discussions on the subreddit on Reddit. That is TaxPros, r/TaxPros on Reddit. As I said, Reddit's kind of the wild west of the internet. But in this particular area, it is a very quiet and, you know, basically makes sense. We're not going to go off the deep end discussion of this. We're not going to talk politics. We're just talking how the tax law works. So, you know, you can get me there too if you want to get into a conversation. Otherwise, you know, stay put. This week, I'm going to be over in Albuquerque doing a couple of days on Monday and Tuesday. Then I come back here to the Valley. I do a couple things locally here for in-firm sessions. The following week, I'm supposed to be doing some sessions in the state of Washington, plus in-firm sessions. And after that, I come back and do a couple of sessions in Phoenix on different rules. You know, so we'll be talking about a lot of these things coming up. So keep your eyes open. There may be more things we can discuss about adding some sessions that will relate to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We're talking with some societies and some other structures about maybe providing guidance. So keep your eyes open. But lots happening. So while this week was quiet, we still have a lot to digest from Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And I suspect we'll continue to have that. So hopefully we'll see you back here next week when hopefully we can actually do a little bit more to try to figure out how the law is working and what's happening.